Next in line, we have audio and video viewing. Now, this is just an advancement on PBX viewing. It's basically the same thing, except in this case, we use audio and video input devices connected to computers for multimedia applications and exploit those to be able to watch or listen. And so, for example, most versions of video and audio equipment currently connected to multimedia workstations are vulnerable to this. You break into the operating system and you turn on the video and watch. And you can see all sorts of interesting things. And you can imagine what happens when we put video phones into our cable system, what you'll see in people's living rooms. And be able to record for subsequent use. Well, publish is not as profitable in most cases, but you know, I guess it depends on sometimes. Some video phone systems are very susceptible to this. Basically, it depends on breaking into the operating environment that's running the audio or video input device. And once you've done that, now there's another problem, and that is to do video viewing, for example, over the internet, you'd better have a high-speed link because it's, you know, a lot of bandwidth in the video camera coming in. But fortunately, we have all sorts of good video compression technology that's now available. So, for those of us that work in the seedier side of the world, there's the repair, replace, and remove information thing. This is where we exploit the repair process to exact, modify, or destroy information. For example, there are computer repair shops that copy information and resell it. Okay, so if you don't have an encrypted disk and you send your computer off, then they have to do a backup to make sure that you don't lose the valuable information on your computer when they do their repair. And to make sure they don't lose your valuable information, they keep the copy of the backup for later. And oh, that's thrilling. This is somebody in the audience because he has encountered people that restored from the wrong backup. So not only did you not get your information, you got somebody else's. Hey. And they got yours. Maybe you should find out whose you got, call them up and trade PCs. And maintenance people introduced computer viruses, another one I mentioned before. And in fact, this is one of the things that a lot of people just ignore, that's a pretty serious problem. There are, as far as I can tell, a substantial number of documented cases in the New York area of people doing this. I haven't been out on this coast that long to hear of many cases, but I would be willing to bet that it's a common practice in the repair business. You know, people underbid other people to get these jobs. There's people get a job working for a repair company so they can steal the information. So maybe the company's not doing it as a company, but the individuals within the company are doing it. And then, of course, people that fake being repairmen. Wire closet attacks. This is where you break into a wire closet. Actually, now, occasionally you get confusion about what a wire room is. Okay. People in the financial industries know that a wire room is a room where you electronically wire funds, electronic funds transfer. People in the telephone business know that a wire room is where all the wires are. I'm talking about wire closets, which normally means the place with a bunch of wires in them. And almost all buildings have them, and most of them are unlocked. I'd say probably 60-70% of the wire closets I encounter are not locked. The rest of them are locked with very easy to pick locks, but that's another issue. Locked and left ajar. There you go. You've encountered that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, all the time. So the rules say we have to lock it, but we can't get in. So we open it up and lock it, then we follow the rules so we can still get in. Yes, sir.
Well, not only did they know where, not only did the client not know where the room was, but I identified myself as an employee of the company to make it. In full access, and then asked for a key to the closet, maintenance staff said, oh, well, you can come. Only borrowed two guys. They had a new screwdriver, watched they vandalized the cabinet, but never got any identification on it.
There you go. That's the high-quality employees that we use in building maintenance, not to mention the guard services that we use. Yes, well, so that's just a good example. Wiretapping, malicious destruction of wiring. Okay? It's not unusual. I've got a client that has a whole bunch of computers that are in some service business. They have, 10,000 wires in some room. And I'll ask them the question, what if I came through here and with a big cutter and went snip, 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 snip? How long would it take you to recover? Now, sometimes I get a really good answer. Sometimes I get a dropping of the jaw. Mostly it's the dropping of the jaw. So malicious destruction of wiring is something very few people consider, but which is far more damaging to most organizations than tapping on an individual line, because you can take a lot of places out of service. The introduction of videotape players into the surveillance channel to hide physical access, we've seen it in all the movies, and yes, it works. So that's another wire-causing attack. And basically, it only takes minimal technology and knowledge to access a wire closet, and it's not a big deal to protect the wire closet, but if you don't do it, they'll take it. Shoulder surfing, the more generic version. Watching over people's shoulders as they use information or information systems. For example, watching them enter their password. We did a watch people entering the passwords experiment in a wide range of environments. And systems administrators are the easiest ones to watch. Especially when they're showing you things about their network. You know, let me show you how my network works. But I just have to log in here as a super user to our routing system. I have to get through the firewall. Wait, okay, now. That's very, very common. watching air travelers as they use their computers and review documents. My goodness. I cannot tell you how much industrial information I can gather by just flying back and forth across the country all the time. I mean, it's amazing. I've seen, strategic plans for Gulf Oil. And by the way, first class is not always a better place to sit. Because in first class, you have a lot of people with a lot of money, but very often they don't work very much in first class. They seem to drink and play a lot. Whereas in business class, now we're talking. Then another variation on that, of course, but we'll still stay in shoulder surfing. By the way, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I was almost took an Air France flight to go out to France a couple months ago, but I just couldn't take it anymore. I just refused to get on when they said that they must check my hand carry luggage. I said, excuse me. We know that the French, they drug people on their planes and put them to sleep and then take their laptops and steal the information. But they've eliminated the problem of having to drug the people now. They just require that they hand them their computer and then they'll just open it and use it. But if you have a good device to protect your laptop, have no fear, they will drug it. But they've alleviated the problem of having to watch over people's shoulders just by stealing it directly. Then observing users to understand standard operating procedures. A little bit more subtle here, okay? Instead of going for something like a password, fine, well, maybe we have a password or not, but what's much more important in a lot of cases is understanding what makes you unobservable, okay? You're trying to hide. What makes it easy to hide? Well, behaving like everybody else. So another aspect of shoulder surfing is just seeing how people do things so that you can do things in the way of everybody else. Get along to go along. Data aggregation, now we're talking high-class, sophisticated stuff that requires a mathematician on your side. And basically, you take legitimately accessible data, you aggregate it to derive unauthorized information. For example, you get the total department salary just before and after the new hire employee comes in. You now know that person's salary. Okay? Attend a bunch of meetings in a particular area and gain overall picture of what work a group is doing. Okay, so for example, I think there was a... Well, maybe I'll go to another thing. Sometimes I have a really good example, but Probably I shouldn't tell you that one. This is one of those things. Tracking movements of many people and correlating the information with job titles to get intelligence information. Okay? You know what job titles are meeting where when. That's a very important piece of intelligence. Especially if you're willing to bug somebody. Because, frankly, if we bugged all the meetings in a typical corporation, we'd go crazy trying to listen to it all. You have to know which one to bug. And of course, data aggregation in general is a very complex thing to perform and protect against. There are all sorts of results that show that it's NP complete to do this or that, depending on what specifically you're looking for. Process bypassing is where you take a normal process and bypass it to gain an advantage. And a typical example is the retail returns department employee. This is a real high-tech crime, right? Somebody that works in the returns department enters false return data. Right? Says, we got the return of a toaster. Well, a toaster's too cheap. We got the return of a VCR. It was busted into 100 pieces. Okay, fine. It's returned. That generates a check to the purchaser. So you enter in the name and address of your cousin as the purchaser. The value of the purchase was $493. They send a check for $493 to your cousin. If they don't do proper inventory control on the returns, they never know. Okay? Things get lost. You take one return, and you enter in your cousin's information on that return, and the other person's return never gets processed. They never get their check. Your cousin gets his check. Cashes a check, walks away with cash. 2 months later, the other person hasn't gotten their check, comes in and complains, and you reprocess it for them. Now they get their check. Right? If you don't have adequate controls, this is fairly straightforward to do. It's an information system thing. You're plugging wrong data in and bypassing the normal process and exploiting that to get it. Another one, use of a computer network to generate extra checks. This was a guy in England who was working for a company, rather large accounting firm, actually. He was working in their computer department, and he noticed that what they did was, when they generated checks, it was all done electronically, they sent it over their LAN, and all the checking was done before they sent the things to the printer. It was just a laser printer that prints checks. So all he did was insert another record at the end, and it printed an extra check made out to him. He did this over a period of about 2.5 years, used it to pay for a university education. The way they found out about it was, after he graduated, and after the statute of limitations had run, he sent them a check for the entire amount that he had borrowed plus interest, explaining what he had done, saying he didn't really mean to do any harm, but he couldn't see any other way to pay for his education. And here was, the reimbursement with interest for all the funds that I took in his pocket. Well, if you can do it honestly, obviously you can do it dishonestly. So there are almost always, there's a point in a system where it's before or after some checking process when the data can be manipulated. And if you find the right place, you can get around it. Altering pricing records to reflect false inventory levels to cover up theft. Okay, you change the value of something. You say this is now worth $5 instead of $4. You steal one-fifth of them and sell them for cash. You actually have fewer of them in inventory, but they're marked as having a greater value. When financial audit comes through, everything adds up the same. It ends up just repricing the thing when it goes and gets sold to somebody. So your price is a little bit higher. Nobody's the wiser. It's very often accomplished by a relatively unsophisticated attacker using only knowledge gained while on the job. Content-based attacks. The content sent to an interpreter causes the interpreter to act wrong. Okay? For example, web-based URLs that bypass firewalls. Here's a typical picture down here. We have a browser inside the firewall that goes out to a malicious site, say, well, just say c2.org, or why not? And they send back in their web page, something like gopher:// all.net:20/0 followed by a user ID password pair, something like that. This browser now, inside the firewall, runs that command over here at all.net on port 23, which happens to be the telnet port. So what's happened here is the content of what was sent back to the browser causes this browser inside the firewall to launch attacks against other computers within the firewall. Okay? That's called a content-based attack. Malicious macros can be written in spreadsheets or word processing languages. Okay? Macro viruses are content-based attacks. You send it an email. They get your spreadsheet or your Word document in an email, and it's got a Trojan horse or a virus or what have you in it. But it's content-based, not form. Compressed archives might contain file names that are the file names of system files, okay, on your DOS machine. And when you uncompress them, it automatically puts them into the proper place in the directory. So it uncompresses a new password file for you. Or like that. So a lot of content-based attacks are very, very simple and easy to derive from published information. They tend to be very quick to operate, very simple to program. Another problem is a lot of people don't protect their backups to the same level that they protect their system. They'll send their backups through, a postal service or UPS or something to some other place that stores their backups to the backup site. And maybe it sits on their loading dock in the meanwhile, waiting for the shipper to come. Well, sitting on your loading dock is a good place for me to attack you. So, for example, they place electromagnetic devices in backup storage areas to erase or corrupt magnetic backups. Okay? I've been on tours of facilities and placed a magnet. Well, magnet right up next to the tape drive. So that when they do their backups, it'll erase it automatically. No problem to do it. Never. Nice tape drive you got there. You put it in the right place, yeah. No bad, yeah. That's content-based attack. That'll work. It'll work. Yes, that works against firewalls. Yes, the problem here is they have to look at the content of the information sent to them, the content of the web page. The thing about content-based attacks that makes them so nasty is there are two aspects. One of them is they're being interpreted by this interpreter here in the browser, in this case, that just blindly does whatever they say. There's no checking in the browser because the browser isn't considered to be a security-critical thing. You put your security here in a firewall that's supposed to be in here, but the firewall, if it's going to check the total content of all the information that moves through it, is going to take an enormous performance hit. Okay? So the problem is, if you're going to get performance out of the firewall, you can't examine all the details of every packet. Suppose it's encoded with UUIN code. Okay? Suppose you have Netscape Secure Commerce Server running, and it's encrypted. It runs through the firewall encrypted. The firewall is only checking it came from a legitimate place, went to a legitimate place. There's a secure channel. Okay? So the security has to be in the interpreter itself, or a content-based attack will work. And of course, we're using all sorts of insecure interpreters. You could be running through here, yeah. You can firewall every machine from every other machine. Okay, let's see. Infection of backup media by computer viruses. Right, you take a backup tape and just put some corrupt information on it. Someday they may restore it. In fact, you might be able to induce them to restore it by corrupting something that you otherwise, you might be able to, for example, if you're a user of a system, intentionally lose a file so that they have to come and get something from backup. And if you corrupt the right information on the backup tape, depending on the backup program, you might get them to, as super user, restore something owned by super user in the process. Okay? It's just because of their because the backup program reads and interprets things in a general purpose way. The theft of backup media being disposed or near the end of its life cycle, I think I brought it up before. So unless you encrypt everything on your backup or protect your backups to the same level that you protect everything else, they're a vulnerable point. I mentioned you can mess up the backup process, but you can also mess up the restoration process, very closely related, obviously. So, for example, you create a fake backup containing false information. You just create it from scratch and send it to the backup storage facility, packaged as if it came from you, from the legitimate place. When they go to read back the backup, it's corrupted. Alter the tape head alignment. Okay, if you have physical access to the tape head for a minute, you turn a little screw and the tape head misaligned, and they go to read back the tapes, and it doesn't work. It says, all my backup tapes are corrupted. Nothing works. But if they do another backup and restore from that backup, that'll work. So they think all their old backups have been corrupted. It's just a tape head misalignment. Use of privileged restoration programs to grant privileges. Sometimes, almost always, the programs that restore things are privileged. Okay, they run as super user on the machine. So if you can trick that program into restoring something to the wrong place, that program might be given super user privileges. For example, with tar tape. With a tar tape, you can set the protection bit. You can say it's owned by root and it's protection bit 4777. That makes it into a set UID program. If the program that restores it is running privileged, it'll give you the ability to take over the whole system anytime you run that program. Okay? So it's fairly complicated to create a fake backup that really works. It helps if you have an original backup. Hang-up hooking. You take actively terminated protocols. Let's see. A typical one is in the telephone system. I can't read very well. I'll try and speak better. In the telephone system, when you hang up, it essentially opens a circuit eventually on the other end of a line. And your modem, for example, looks for that open circuit. And if it's open for so long, depending on the setting of the modem, it'll figure out that it's hung up and then send another termination signal on down the line. But it might be that the phone system works at a different timing than your modem timing. So a line can actually be hung up, and then the next call can come in and be answered before the modem has hung up. Okay, so depending on the timing, all sorts of stuff can happen. Like modem hang-up failures, we've logged in terminal sessions. I have, in one case, I was doing for a university class a demo. I was doing a demo that was on a remote machine somewhere, and I wasn't intending to demo this particular problem, but I accidentally encountered it, ended up in this machine across the United States, logged in as some other user. Just by accident. Another one is interrupted telnet sessions taken over by attackers that prevent the proper protocol completion and refusing to completely disconnect a callback modem at the central office, okay, can cause the callback mechanism to fail. Okay, so callback modems, if you can get to the CO, to the PBX, either one of those, you can defeat callback mechanisms. Nicer ways with call forwarding fakery. This is one of my favorites. Use a computer-controlled call forwarding to forward calls on callback modems to you. Okay, so that when they... You take wherever they're going to call to, you tell the PBX that's running it to forward calls that go to the callback number over to your number, and when the callback mechanism does its callback, it gets forwarded to you. So, in fact, if you do this right, every callback from that callback modem comes back to you instead of to whoever called in. So you get sort of pre-logged in sessions. They just come at you as whoever did it. Forward calls to illegitimate locations to intercept communications. Okay, you get an inbound call. You then conference it back out to whoever the legitimate recipient was, and you created a man-in-the-middle situation where you're listening to all the traffic going back and forth that's coming through you, but each side thinks it's all legitimate. And using programmable call forwarding to cause long-distance calls to be billed to the forwarding party's account. Oh, this is one of my... You break into a PBX, and you enter in where you want calls forwarded to for user Joe, and then you call user Joe, his phone number, and the PBX forwards the call using their telephone line to Zimbabwe. You're now calling Zimbabwe at their expense using the call forwarding mechanism. There's another one like that. I'm not sure if we'll encounter it. I'll bring it up now, and if we see it later, then I'll mention that that was it. It's a variation on the theme. You break into a voicemail box. You record, yes, 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 yes. What am I going to do with yes, 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 yes? Now I call up one of these automated... You call up one of these phone companies and say, I want to make a third-person call. Right? Third-party calling says, I want a call that's approved by them. Charge their number for it, and they'll approve it. Well, the phone companies now have automated systems to do all the approval process. So they call up, their computer calls up and says, Mr. Bronstein would like to call, such and such an area code and bill it to you. Is that all right with you? Okay, and this is it's all a computer. And now it hears back, yes, yes, yes. It says, okay, call approved. Off it goes. That's very nasty. And turns out it's almost always easy to find a voicemail box with an easy-to-guess password or an original password or uninitialized or something like that when you go into a PBX, into a voicemail system. So you set up a bunch of these to say yes for you automatically. Illegal value insertion. You take values that are not supposed to be allowed. The specification says, zero does this, one does that. Never said what two does. I'll try it. Well, it turns out, for example, you put in a negative date. And putting in a negative date in some cases has produced negative interest, which accrues to your benefit. cash withdrawal values. There's a case where you put in a cash withdrawal value that was so large it overflowed the integer. The input was an unsigned integer, but the calculation was a signed integer. So you put in a number that has that bit as a 1, that first bit as a 1, and it hands you a whole pile of cash and then says that you deposited it. So it adds to your account while handing you the cash. Never go over balance that way. Pointer value sent to a system call is another one. I think I mentioned that earlier. It gets into the wrong address space. And most of these are fairly easy to carry out once you discover them, but systematically discovering them is fairly hard. And in fact, if it was easy, then we would do that to test. Okay, actually, in some cases, we should be testing things that we don't, because all these obvious ones that I pointed out to you are things that you should find in testing. I say that with hindsight. Residual data gathering, data left as a result of incomplete or inadequate deletion, for example, is gathered. Object reuse attacks, like in DOS, when you delete something and somebody else undeletes it. That's an example. Electromagnetic analysis of deleted media lets you get deleted bits. Okay? So, for example, even if you overwrite a disk with values, I can go to my electron microscope. I just happen to have one down the hall. And with my scanning electron microscope, I might be able to pick out your bits, even after you've overwritten it some number of times. Right? And it's just a little bit harder if you've overwritten it more times. But that's the electron microscopy. Short of the electron microscopy, you can use electromagnetic analysis of the media because the right heads don't align exactly the same each time. So if you just slightly move the right head over, the head over, you might be able to read the old data, which is slightly misaligned from the new data. So if they only overwrite it once, it's almost always easy. Using without an electron microscope, you don't even need one. There's depending on how well you delete things, it gets harder and harder to get your data back and more expensive to get your data back. And eventually, if you're willing to really burn everything, you know, if you get it up to a high enough temperature for long enough, probably I won't be able to get your data back. How high, how long? That's an interesting question. Privilege program misuse. Programs with privileges are misused. For example, you are the person that does the backup process. You have legitimate access to do restoring of backups. You introduce the backup tape. Okay? You have access to a privileged program, but you don't have the privilege yourself. So you use the program to do this. Misuse of an automated script. Right? So you have something that uses automated script. So what you do is you find some way to modify the script so that the automated script processor processes it for you. Okay? And configuration management tools. Okay? You have some configuration management tool, you modify it slightly so that the management tool manages a misconfiguration that you know how to break into. Error-induced misoperation is one that's only really been explored lately, and it's one of the things that makes it more exciting. What you do is you create errors to induce incorrect operation. For example, you create a faulty network connection to deny network services. Okay? You intentionally introduce an incorrect data that results in an incorrect output. Okay? It's garbage in, garbage out. You feed garbage to the program, it gives you garbage out. Maybe somebody uses that garbage for some purpose, and it screws them up. Another one is use of scratched or bent up diskettes. You put them in the disk drive and you wipe out the disk head, causing the disk head to permanently fail. A more recent example is where they take smart cards and intentionally introduce errors to cause the smart card to reveal the encryption key that it's using to do encryption. Okay, so there are all sorts of things you can do with key devices and these sorts of things by introducing errors. Audit suppression. Basically, anytime you use audits, if your mechanism for assuring the audit is correct and always made is not perfect, then I can prevent it. So overloading the audit mechanisms with irrelevant data. Okay, so you have your auditing turned up to the max, so I'm going to open up, I'm going to do 500,000 file opens that fail, because there's no such file. You're going to record each of those 500,000, and in there somewhere, I'm going to actually try something that your audit record might detect. Now, if you have automated audit analysis, you might find that. But if you have manual audit analysis, after you get my audit trail of 500,000 things, you're not going to look through it all. You're going to say, oh, man. You're going to call me on the phone and say, what happened? You say, I put the wrong file name in a program, and it was in a loop. I screwed up. Okay, well, don't do it again. Go away. Meanwhile, they didn't pick up the audit trail and might break it. Let's see. Network packet corruption to prevent network-based audit trails. So you get packets coming through a network, sequences of packets that are an audit trail, and you just introduce a fake packet into that sequence that causes a checksum to be wrong. You get the wrong checksum, it says throw out this whole packet. Now, because audit trails have to be sort of real-time to keep up, if you succeed at doing that, it probably will not have a resend mechanism on the audit trail, and that audit trail will never get through. Now, a lot of them use UDP. So if I can screw up a UDP port or overload a UDP port, then the audit trails won't get through. And consuming some resource critical to the auditing process. For example, consuming all the file handles, causing the audit to be unable to open the audit file. That fails, producing yet another audit record, which it cannot audit. And it's now missed two audit records. And it turns out this is particularly nice, and as I mentioned earlier, in the password guessing attack or anything where you're trying a large number of possibilities, if you can suppress audits, you can keep yourself from being detected. This class of attacks, as far as I can tell, has not been thoroughly analyzed, but it appears that audit suppression is fairly straightforward in most systems, including some systems it should not be straightforward in. this is closely related and tied nicely into induced stress failures. This is where I induce stress on things, causing them to fail. For example, paging monsters that create excessive paging and reduce performance. This is, I create a program that has one byte per page. That byte says, go to the next page. Anytime I get into memory, it's going to load all my pages, run through them very quickly to force the paging algorithm to page all my pages in. And then whenever it's time for you to run, you have to kick out my pages. Okay, it's called a paging monster. Process viruses I brought up earlier, they just consume system resources. Also, in the case of process viruses, the normal killing of a process tree might not be fast enough to keep up with the reproduction of viruses, because you only typically have one process killing off other processes, whereas the viruses multiplied and you might have 5,000 viruses reproducing. 5,000 processes all reproducing, one process killing them off. If the prioritization isn't right, then the viruses will always have more of those than the killing process can ever keep up with. So it'll chase its own tail. Not to mention other things won't get killed because it's off trying to kill you. Large numbers of network packets per unit time will tie up systems by forcing excessive high priority network traffic processing. So some of these are really easy without substantial effort. In general, understanding the implications of stress on a multiprocessing environment is very complicated and well beyond current theory. And here's an example of an attack. I put a Trojan horse into a bunch of, some PC program that gets sent out into the world, very popular. And at some date and time, it goes to all their modems and dials 911. Or if you're in Europe, 01, 099, whatever it is. Different codes for different countries. Plain as it calls emergency services, the 911 lines get overloaded very quickly. Okay, in fact, if you do it by putting the modem on silence, then the user probably won't even notice that it's taking place. So now you have tons of computers all over the city, all dialing 911, taking out emergency services. It's an induced stress failure, inducing stress on the 911 telephone system. Hardware system failure or flaw exploitations. Known hardware system flaws are exploited by the attacker. For example, there was a case where there was an operating system call that could, an instruction you could execute that would power down the computer. And it was authorized to, it was non-privileged users could run it if you knew what the instruction was. This was a while back. So somebody accidentally tried it, and they had to power that 360 back up. And they found the instruction and eliminated that. There's an actual power down instruction. I guess Macintoshes have power down instructions, don't they? You could accidentally power down a Mac. Oh, yeah. I should have remembered in the voice input. Well, I'll get to that. Causing an operating system to use results of known calculation error. Okay, you have a microprocessor that multiplies incorrectly. Nobody would ever have a math unit that would. So if it multiplies incorrectly and you can get the operating system to actually use that calculation for something or another, you can get a wrong answer. Maybe it's the wrong answer that produces a pointer that points into your address space instead of somebody else's address space. And now you have access. Sending a packet with a parameter that's improperly handled by a network component. We haven't seen any of those, have we? Let's see, there's the old ping packet that's full length, which takes down all the suns in the world. Right? Suppose I send out an IP packet and it has a from address of 0.0.0.0. What do you think will happen? I don't know. Do you know? Suppose I send out an IP packet that has a from address of 0.0.0.0. What happens? Well, you have a firewall. How do you specify addresses in your firewall to be blocked? A zero means anything. This is actually an address of zero. It's not supposed to exist. Oops. But, I'm just 255.255.255.255. Right? What happens if you send a from address of 255.255.255.255? The answer is nobody knows. And so you've done it. And it, once you've done it, then you realize that we shouldn't have used this code for that thing. That OR operator was not quite right for this. So it turns out there are all sorts of things that you can take out that way. Discovering these kinds of flaws in general, at least as complicated as software flaws and hardware flaws, are basically the same. These are all NP-complete problems to solve. Try to make sure that they don't have any such things. False updates, causing legitimate updates to be made, illegitimate updates to be made. For example, sending a forged update disk containing a hack code to a victim. Ever get an update to Microsoft whatever? Oh, you never get those. But it's fairly, when IBM was on top, I was just as brutal to them. So sending forged update disks is actually fairly common. Interrupting the normal distribution channel, putting in an intentionally flawed distribution, all you have to do is intercept the UPS package at the front door. There's the UPS guy. You know, I'm the secretary of the front door, sure. How much does it take to bribe the secretary? Submitting a false update disk for a real one at the vendor or customer site is always a good one. Maybe in the delivery from the vendor to the duplicating facility would be a good place to introduce something. No, wait, that's been done. You don't remember that one? Oh, well. I think it was, McAfee had one of those too. Yeah, the virus scanner, the chip with the virus, yeah, well, that's all. I mean, it's common. It's fairly easy to do. Network service or protocol attacks. Characteristics of network services are exploited. For example, you create an infinite protocol loop with UDP packets. For example, the echo packet under Internet Protocol. You send an echo packet that has the same from address as the to address. It gets into an infinite loop. It's high priority. It takes down the machine. Well, we did an experiment on a particular machine and only takes 70% of the performance. But if you send a second one, then you've got them. You can also do it between two, and it's not just echo. There are all sorts of UDP protocols that have this property. Use of information packets under the network news transfer protocol to map out a remote site. NNTP has a protocol that says, map the path from here to there so I can make my news delivery as efficient as possible. You just do the same call. Well, it turns out this one is mostly not implemented because even though it's in the protocol, it's too sophisticated for the authors. And the use of source quench protocol. That's another good one, right? In IP, there's a source quench protocol that says, you're going too fast. You're going to slow down. So all you do is you send a whole bunch of source quench packets and it slows down. Eventually it slows down to just about dead stop. So trying to analyze protocol specifications to find these sorts of things is fairly straightforward. It is fairly complex. There are methods to do it, but the average programmer cannot do it, and most of the protocols, it's not been done for, at least not that I'm aware of. Distributed coordinated attacks. I think I'm going to get a sore throat by this afternoon. Distributed coordinated attacks, where you have a set of attackers that use a set of intermediary systems to attack a set of victims. If you really want to know about it, I'm giving a talk on it on Wednesday at 11 to 12:15 or something. I'll be giving a whole hour or so on distributed coordinated attacks, the same as the talk I gave last year. They just said it was so popular they wanted to do it again. Basically, you have a bunch of attackers. They go through some number of intermediaries to attack a set of victims. For example, a web-based attack, based attack causing thousands of browsers to attack a single victim site, that's one of those. A set of simultaneous attacks by a coordinated group of attackers, and there should be another one there somewhere. Devising DCAs appears to be simple, and tracking it to a source is quite difficult. Man-in-the-middle attack. The attacker puts himself between two communicating parties, intercepts and relays information between the parties so that each believes they're talking directly with the other one. In fact, they're communicating through the intermediary.